From WLVR Bethlehem and Lehigh University, this is the show that gets you behind the real lives of Lehigh faculty. This is Prof Talk.
What's going on, guys? You're tuned into Prof Talk here on WLVR 91.3. I'm joined in the studio today by Professor L. Berkey from Lehigh's
Department of Journalism and Communication and Africana Studies.
Thank you. So why don't you just introduce yourself and sort of what you teach? And
okay, well, as we just said, I have a dual appointment in two departments, in Africana Studies and in the Department of Journalism and Communication. And my scholarship focuses on the relationship between media and society. Specifically, I investigate the ways that media functions as a social institution to really shape our interactions and shape dominant perspectives on different groups of people. And, you know, that's really the gist of it.
That's awesome. I have to say that I've been very excited for this interview, especially since there are some big happenings, especially down in Baltimore currently, and especially with what's been happening on this campus in the past few years. But before we get to that, I just was wondering sort of what are some of the trends that you see in media relations, especially with our generation coming up?
Okay, well, my courses, I'll tell you what my courses are.
Sure.
Because they kind of help in terms of understanding that relationship. But I teach three courses. I teach global media and culture. I teach new media, race and gender. And I teach media and race. In terms of understanding the relationship that the college age generation has to media, I would make the argument that it's really in many ways replacing and shaping social interactions in a way that it never has. You guys are the first generation to walk around with cell phones everywhere you go. Everyone has personal computers, and really the smartphones are becoming personal computers. So much of what you all do in terms of your communication with each other, your communication with, all of those things are really shaped by media.
What do you think is detrimental based on that new relationship between technology and our generation, and what do you think are some of the pros?
Okay, so in terms of what's detrimental, it's difficult to say because media scholars have always kind of tried to investigate the ways that new media technology reconfigure human interaction. So I'm sure there was some scholar that was afraid of the telephone, or some scholar that was afraid of the ways that television would impact human relation, and they have. Marshall McLuhan and Neil Postman, those are two theorists who really investigate this relationship. So understanding how it's detrimental is very difficult to assess because it's always on some level potentially detrimental. But if I had to say, I would make the argument that it is making it difficult for people to have face-to-face interactions in the way that they once did. And I even know this from my personal life. You go out go to have coffee or go out to eat, and everyone's got their smartphone on their table, on the table with them, and that may interfere with the communication that they have. Or, you know, this level of superficial connection that we have via social media, such as Twitter or Facebook. So, you know, on one level, that's good, and this kind of can answer the second part of your question in terms of the positives. That's good because we have this opportunity to speak with people who we either wouldn't know or wouldn't have as much interaction with because of the distance. So, you know, space and time is really made a lot smaller. But we're also not pushed to have face-to-face interaction in the same ways that we once were because we have this ongoing, mediated, more superficial connection.
Now, do you think that due to social media such as Facebook and Twitter that people have sort of moved to an idealized view of themselves? They can sort of present themselves the way that they want to, and it's less based on sort of their trials and tribulations and who they really are as a person, and more what they want other people to see?
Yeah, I think I would have to agree that there's a lot more individual control over what you perceive to be your public image, and that this would then also have an impact on your identity, your sense of self. There's a lot more of an opportunity to protect people who, or for people to protect themselves from kind of the backstage image of who they are. I think Goffman talks about front stage, backstage, and this opportunity that media might give us to always have our best look showing up. You know, we minimize the likelihood that we would be represented or represent ourselves in a way that we don't want to. You know, perfect example would be the opportunity to take a picture over and over and over again.
Yeah, yeah, until you get it right.
And then decide which one you like.
Oh, I'm totally guilty of that. 100%.
Everyone is. Everyone is.
So I guess, do you sort of see a decline in sense of self in our generation? Especially, I mean, there's been tons and tons written about Facebook depression and anxiety that you start to see that seems very, very novel to our generation and kids of our age.
Well, there was, there has been some research that that's come out that says that people who are regular users of Facebook end up in a space where they think that everyone else has a lot better of a life than they do, and they
start
to compare because people only take the best parts of what they deal with on a regular basis and they put it up. So it looks like everyone has this super life where they eat all this exotic food and go to all these really cool places, and that might not necessarily be the case. So on one level, yes, I think that there is probably some good, you know, scholarly support for this idea. But then in terms of the self, you kind of made this point of are people how people kind of see themselves as individuals.
Sure.
I would make the argument that people are extremely self-centered as a result of social media.
Oh, definitely. I would agree with that 100%.
It creates all of these, like, really interesting opportunities to focus on yourself and to force others to pay attention to who you are with, like, status updates and random thoughts that you
using Facebook as a diary.
Yeah, or even using Twitter to share your random thoughts that you decide to broadcast that, you know, maybe shouldn't necessarily be deserving of the platforms that they get.
I know at least my big gripe with Facebook, because I've been trying to drop it for the past few months, but it sucks you back in.
Mm-hmm.
You know what I mean? It's almost like I'm conditioned to want to check it every 5 minutes.
Yeah.
And the best analogy that I've heard of it is it's like a fridge when you're bored. Mm-hmm. So you go up to the fridge, you open up the fridge, you see there's nothing there that you like, close the fridge, but you're back 5 minutes and yet nothing has changed.
That is so true. Or you just sit there and you go down your timeline,
yep,
and you just look at the videos people posted or the pictures or this or the, you repost something. It's a time stealer.
Yeah,
also,
absolutely. But the thing is, it's such a good communication technique, especially with group projects and stuff in college, that I know at least a lot of people that I've talked to have had a very, very hard time dropping it.
Yeah, I think you're right. And then, you know, I tell my students about the time that I missed an invite to a birthday party because it was posted on Facebook.
Yeah.
And I'm like, oh, like, you know, there was just this expectation that everyone accessed Facebook regularly and everyone would be invited via Facebook. And so if you weren't on Facebook, you were excluded.
Mm-hmm.
So, you know, again, not to get all academic-y on you, but there are certainly theories to support that push that even kind of there are four groups of people who utilize and consume media. And then this last group is the group that's forced into utilization because they simply are isolated or, you know, marginalized in society if they don't. And my being required to get on Facebook because my friends were starting to only invite you to parties via Facebook is a perfect example of that force.
Sure. Now, switching gears here a bit, this is a question that I've always wanted to ask a professor in your line of study. One of the things that I've always been interested about is how text messaging and instant communication has affected relationships in our generation.
Mm-hmm.
Because at least what I see now, I mean, back when my parents were dating and they didn't see each other every day.
Right.
You know what I mean? There was the distance where, you know, when you saw somebody, you were the only person, you were the only center of interaction.
Mm-hmm.
You know what I mean?
Mm-hmm.
And now it seems like if I'm not texting a girl all day, I'm not interested.
Right.
Get what
That's
I'm saying?
A great point.
But at the same time, it's not that. It's just,
you're living your life.
I'm living my life. Exactly. I'm living my life. And if I were to text her all day, every day, we'd have nothing to talk about in person.
That's a really, really good theory. And good luck finding a young lady who can appreciate
that.
Great way to see it. So two things in response to that. The first one is I think just, you know, even again from conversations with my students when we talk about this type of thing, you know, social media or changes in media technology such as texting or FaceTiming or Skype or all these other ways that you can be constantly in contact with other people, it does create a level of insecurity that wasn't there before when you don't hear from somebody, right? And a need to continuously engage that person, even if it's just a hello text or a good morning text or something of that nature. So I agree with you in terms of how that's reshaping social relationships. But another thing that I remember sharing this example with some of my students about how, you know, I'm old enough to remember the time where people actually met someone in the frozen food aisle, right?
Oh,
where,
right?
Like, you would be getting your stuff or doing what you're doing in the grocery store, and a gentleman, if you were interested, would simply say hello. And then a conversation, if you were interested as well, would develop from that. And I laugh with my students about the idea that if, in today's world, if someone says hello to you,
oh, it's
you're
creepy.
Freaked out.
Yeah.
You're freaked out.
No, 100%.
And so it's like this kind of way that I would say that that's another really interesting way that social media or that media technology has reshaped or reconfigured human interaction. And then also to kind of incorporate some of the themes that show up in my courses in New Media, Race, and Gender, one of the articles that I've used in the past and I'm probably going to end up using again in the future is one that looks at dating habits by race and gender and the use of social media to date. And so kind of the ways that dating websites that are becoming increasingly normalized as a way of meeting someone have all of these opportunities for you to eliminate people.
Oh, it's all demographics now. Mm-hmm. I mean, you have Christian Mingle, mm-hmm. you have Farmer Date,
oh,
personal favorite.
I think I heard that there was a gluten-free
there is dating. anything you can find, there is a dating service for it.
Right. And so the research is showing not only that certain groups are being eliminated from this process, and in particular in the United States, those are men who are Asian American and women who are African American are largely being excluded as partners, from the dating pool. Probably because of a series, and again, going back to the themes of my class, a series of stereotypes that are associated with both groups that really most importantly have to do with a violation of gender norms, Asian American men represented as overly feminine and African American women represented as emasculating to men or even masculine in some instances. So, you know, there's a way in which that means that certain members of the population are excluded, but then it also means that the likelihood that you would meet someone who you wouldn't initially be attracted to but have a lot in common with, that
drops down.
It drops down, and that's kind of unfortunate because you know, someone who you might not think would be a good partner for you might very well be that partner. But because of the dating website or the dating opportunities or the opportunities to eliminate potential partners that you don't think you might like, it kind of changes things. But another kind of plus side to it is that there's been an increase in like interracial dating. People are more likely to, if they're interested in someone who doesn't have the same racial background as them, they might not approach that person in face-to-face communication, but they might be more likely to take that leap online. So, you know, there's a plus and a minus to it. And I know my students are also talking about the swipe. What is it? Is it Tinder?
Tinder. I wanted to get to that.
Oh my gosh, I'm learning about that.
Yeah, because I mean it's definitely interesting because nobody looks at the profiles. You know what I mean? That's nobody looks at the information that people are giving out. It's basically down to looks.
Right.
100%. That's just yes, no, yes,
right.
no.
Right. 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 We live in a society that is saturated by images, and it's we're a very visual society, a very image-based society, and we also think that we can make certain assessments about a person's character based upon their physical appearance. So, you know, I mean, that's how it's been, but it's just different. It's showing up differently now.
How would you say it's different?
I would say it's different than it has been in the past, in the sense that I would make the argument that at least in face-to-face interactions, you're forced to pick up on other forms of communication that go above and beyond just the physical appearance of the person. So, you know, I know a lot of young women who have been attracted to a guy because he's funny. And if you're just looking at his profile, you don't know that he's a funny guy that's going to make you laugh and you're going to really enjoy that, you know? So when you think of media technology and kind of the way that we use physical appearance in media technology, it again changes that the dynamic where it's solely based upon your physical appearance. And there's a lot of opportunity for those people who are engaging in this process to manipulate their appearance online.
Mm-hmm. Photoshop?
Yep.
Oh, Photoshop. You're tuned into Prof Talk with Professor Al Berkey here on WLVR 91.3 FM, Bethlehem. So the next thing that I want to get into is, based on what's happening in Baltimore, what are your thoughts on how the media is portraying what is going on? Because obviously there's, you know, the majority of the people down there who are acting are peaceful protesters. But it seems like all I am seeing on my Facebook feed, on CNN, on MSNBC, are pictures of looters. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. And it's such a small minority, but at the same time, you know, it's dominating all of my cues.
Right. Right. Well, one thing that we need to remember is that media functions as it functions as a pseudo-social institution.
Sure.
So it's not actually, it has the kind of impact on society that other social institutions do, but unlike maybe government or the educational system, it doesn't have the same regulatory process.
Mm-hmm.
And so, and it actually is privatized and it's based in it's commercialized, right? So this is a really interesting paradox because the role of those who produce content for media is to maintain viewership and
sure.
to sensationalize. So there's going to be this component of sensationalization anytime you get coverage of social issues, right,
mm-hmm.
as they show up. And then incorporating the component of race and also the racial hierarchy, you know, part of my research, I work in cultural studies and,
sure.
and race and ethnicity. And I would make the argument that, you know, as a social institution in many ways and as a privatized institution, I would make the argument that media does a good job of maintaining the status quo when it comes to perspectives of marginalized groups.
Mm-hmm.
And so one of the dominant perspectives of the black, quote unquote, black underclass or the African-American inner city poor
sure.
is that there is a chaotic and culturally dysfunctional component to this community.
Mm-hmm.
And so I would make the argument that that's what we're getting because that's what we anticipate as viewers. And that's what, unfortunately, we're most comfortable with as a society. When it comes to actually seeing the content, and I told my students this, I am being cautious about what I actually view, and I'm taking my time. I've looked at a couple of stories in the New York Times, and I know this might sound pretty contradictory as a media scholar, but I'm kind of taking my time as I come to terms with what's going on in Baltimore.
Mm-hmm.
Because as I mentioned to my students in class, you know, I think that it's time to think about why this keeps happening. And the social history of this instance, you know, riots in poor neighborhoods of color
mm-hmm.
is nothing new to the American landscape.
Especially not in Baltimore.
And especially not in Baltimore. There's a long history.
Mm-hmm.
And so maybe it might be time to look bigger than
mm-hmm.
just these communities and determine that there's some form of cultural dysfunction there.
Now, what would you say, based on your studies, you think are the drivers of this unrest that happens in inner cities? And it seems like it's, you know, it's always been there, 90s, back in the 60s and 70s in Baltimore, but it seems like we're seeing more and more of it recently.
Okay. So, okay, in terms of the drivers, and then I'll come to your question about why we're seeing more and more of it. In terms of the drivers, what we're seeing when we see any poor community, and this is across racial lines, is we're seeing people with little to no social capital or resources.
Sure.
But we're still seeing inequities, and we're seeing rage showing up. When the wealthy are enraged, their rage shows up in where their money goes, or
mm-hmm.
it shows up in terms of which politicians they support, or, you know, in other ways. When the poor are angry, it shows up in ways that reflect the social context
mm-hmm.
that they find themselves in. So that's why I say, again, we need to look larger and not try to hone in on what's going on in this community, but rather what's going on with systemic inequality.
Sure.
Why we're seeing more? We're seeing more, I would say, because of media technology.
Mm-hmm.
And so more exposure. We are also living in a space of the prosumer. I apologize to the scholar. I'll explain that in a moment. Well, I apologize to the scholar. I feel like his name is Ritzer, who came up with that terminology. But the producer consumer of media mm-hmm. content, the prosumer is the one who can take their smartphone and take a video and post it on YouTube. And that video gets a lot of exposure, and also the person that can consume the media. So particularly when it comes to instances of brutality in communities and poor communities of color, this has always been around. It's just that it looks like every time we quote unquote turn around, an African American man is being brutalized by the police, and it keeps happening, or a murder or something of that nature, only because we are seeing more of it.
Okay.
I would say that this, unfortunately, is something that's always kind of been a reality for many sure. people.
So what do you think are the necessary steps to alleviate some of the things that are causing this unrest?
Oh, gosh.
I'm going to put you on the spot here.
I don't have that answer. I'm going to gracefully bow out of responding.
That is completely fair.
I'm afraid to think of there are so many different sure. ways to approach it. And now, that's not to say that that's not a question you shouldn't be asking me.
Mm-hmm.
That is certainly a question that you should be asking me and any other scholar who claims to be someone who investigates issues of social
sure.
inequality. But I'm still not going to answer.
Fair enough. You're tuned into Prof Talk here on WLVR 91.3 FM, Bethlehem. So I guess the question that I have for you is, based on demographics, we have a large portion of our government and people in positions of power who are starting to age and who are about to step out of positions of power and be filled by people of our generation. Do you think, based on our generation's preferences towards race and being, I like to think, a little more open
okay.
than the older generations. Mm-hmm. Do you think that will help to change it in and of itself?
Well, I do agree that your generation self-identifies as open-minded.
Mm-hmm.
And there's nothing wrong with that perspective. And I think that that's at least on some level the beginning of social change. But again, going back to the types of points that I make to my students, and especially like in this last few weeks of class, what my students
sure.
have done is they've done projects where they have investigated the relationship between either gender and race and media, or race and media, and we've looked at the instances of racial stereotypes that continue to show up mm-hmm. in contemporary media. And one of the really things that makes me so proud as a professor that my students have been able to do as a result of our conversations is to make the connections between the representations that they see now and the ones that have shown up historically.
Mm-hmm.
And what we find is that they're just basically an updated version of these age-old stereotypes. So understanding that, and understanding that as much as it appears that media representations have changed, there are really many ways that they've just been updated.
Mm-hmm.
One of them, for instance, is the racial harmony representation. And the racial harmony representation is what we might see in the real world, or, you know, one of the first corporations to do it was United Colors of Benetton, where they put like people of different racial or ethnic backgrounds in their commercials. But we also see it in like H&M and sometimes like mm-hmm. Tommy Hilfiger. So we'll see this kind of bringing together, or McDonald's does it too, this bringing together of people from different backgrounds who are all in the same space. But the racial harmony representation, though, is a little bit of an illusion. It's not a little bit, it actually is an illusion, in the sense that people are still engaging in the racially stereotypical behaviors
mm-hmm.
that we associate with different groups, right? So you guys are in a generation where this is kind of what's showing up. And I would make the argument that as a result of that, your younger college-age generations feel more open-minded and feel that they have more understanding of people who are not like them racially, and more of a
sure.
comfort level, right? At the same time, you know, as I said before, they are still consuming stereotypes.
Mm-hmm.
And then in addition to that, we have the creation of kind of mainstream mainstream rap music as pop culture, which I don't want to plug, but I'll, you know, be dealing with those issues in a presentation at the Interplay Hip Hop Symposium later this week. But we kind of get this additional creation of, or illusion of, interaction. So we have all that showing up in media, but we still largely live in a world where people are in communities with others who look very much like them.
Sure.
So what I always tell my students is that your defense against misrepresentations in media, or stereotypical representations in media, or the illusion of diversity in media, is to actually build interactions with people who are unlike you.
Mm-hmm.
So if anything, I would, and I always leave my students with this message, and I would leave it to the listeners who are young adults. If you're really invested in being open-minded, you need to build a true friendship with people who are completely different from mm-hmm. you. And even if it begins as superficial, it will not remain superficial. And that's really the way that people who are younger, who are going into positions of power in the future, mm-hmm. would actually be able to engage in the process of having a more open-minded perspective and becoming more sympathetic to people who are not like them and better understanding.
So I just wanted to highlight also, I believe you actually talked about similar concepts in the Huffington Post article that you
yes.
wrote on the heels of the FBR incident that happened 2 years ago at this school. I wanted to highlight a particular passage, few lines, that really interested me, in that you talked about how our generation, like you said, identifies as open-minded but doesn't have a means to communicate it because
right.
we haven't really had any issues where we've had to deal with it.
Right.
And I know at least on this campus, after that event happened, a lot of people wanted to have a dialogue about it and discuss what happened, but everybody shied away because they didn't want to look like they were either being insensitive or stepping on anybody's toes.
Right.
I believe the word you used was militant in one case, and then
insensitive,
in the other case,
understanding.
Sure.
Yeah, so before we do that, I should clear up, because I know some of the FBR students that I don't know how they would feel about us calling it the FBR incident. It was more of, you know, just more of like, you know, racial slurs showing up on Umoja
mm-hmm.
House, right?
Yeah.
And then their kind of their response to that, right? So, but in terms of like what happened, so part of the racial harmony discourse that shows up in media, in combination with that, we also have a privatization of discussions about race. So you
mm-hmm.
guys are also the post-race generation, the colorblind race, colorblind generation, the generation that has grown up in spaces where you are told that inequality is something of the past, and that
mm-hmm.
everyone has equal opportunities. And as a matter of fact, there's really no need to discuss racial inequality because it's something that's no longer a part of the social environment on some level. I know I'm like kind of
very macro overview.
But so that's kind of one of the dilemmas that's shown up. And in an attempt to be politically correct, one could make the argument that the parents of people who are becoming college age have eliminated the discussion of
mm-hmm.
race from the conversation, with the hope that their children will not see color and will engage with people based upon the content of their character. Unfortunately, our world has not caught up to that idealized perspective. And
mm-hmm.
every time we have an instance of police terrorism of men of color, or some other form of brutality in communities of color, or a response, or any other kind of, you know, a racial slur showing up, anything that you can think of across the board in terms of issues, social issues that are connected to racial inequality, we find that we're not prepared to deal with them
mm-hmm.
because rather than actually saying, you know, something that's more straightforward and maybe building interactions with people and true friendships with people who are racially different, we've kind of all been fed this discourse of everything's okay and we
mm-hmm.
don't need to discuss it. So just to kind of, you know, summarize everything that I've said in a very concise way, with the hope that people can somehow apply it to their lives, you know, many people that I've engaged with have been told that race doesn't matter, but they haven't actually been given the means for it to not matter in their life. Does that make sense?
Absolutely.
Yeah. So, and as I said before, you know, the best way to do that is to, like, eat dinner at the friend's house once a week,
mm-hmm.
or they eat dinner at your house, like stuff that goes beyond just hello every day in the office mm-hmm. or in class as
people or casual conversation.
Yeah, it needs to be a true friendship, and mm-hmm. And that happens over time. Now, another really good thing about people who are in your generation is that you guys are in a space where you can actually do that. You mm-hmm. know what I mean? Unlike maybe someone who is in the corporate world where, you know, there's not a lot of room for informal interaction. Mm-hmm. You know, you guys are in a space where you can decide when you come into class that you're going to make a connection with someone mm-hmm. who's very different from you. Like I said before, you know, it's something that you do across time, but it's something that you do to help yourself when you get in spaces that you, you know, where you are susceptible to stereotypes. And sure. it helps you because you remember your friend. One of the things I always tell my students, I also say, you guys have been in a classroom for an entire semester with a Muslim woman who's not a terrorist. You got to remember me, you know, and I say that and next time you're in a place where you see those same mm-hmm. things showing up and you see that same kind of discourse showing up, you guys got to think back to Professor L. Berkey and remember that you have someone who you built a relationship with across a semester mm-hmm. who showed up as a regular American. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
So, you know, that's the only way we can deal with this, in my opinion.
You're tuned into Prof Talk here on WLVR 91.3 FM, Bethlehem. So going back, one of the things that I actually had no idea I was going to ask you about, but you just mentioned, was the talk that you're about to give with hip-hop and culture. Can you just give us a little bit of a highlight on
yeah,
that?
Yeah, I will. And it's actually coming out this weekend, the Interplay Hip-Hop Symposium. Professor Cashy Johnson is producing this event, and a series of, you know, a number of scholars from the Lehigh community are appearing and are speaking at it, including me. My talk is, and I'm kind of remembering it, I think I called it Are You a Thug? And it's Parasocial Contact and Mainstream Rap Representations of Black Masculinity mm-hmm. or African American Men. And so in that conversation, what I'll be doing is talking to the audience about the dominant representation of Black masculinity in mainstream rap music. And the reason I say mainstream rap music is because I would hate for the impression to be given that I think that hip hop as a cultural movement mm-hmm. is doing a disservice to Black men.
Mm-hmm.
I would make the argument that commercialized rap representations that show up in maybe like a Young Thug or a French Montana mm-hmm. or, and I'm trying here as someone who's older to try to remember some of the key people, Lil Wayne, even Chris Brown, like that in some of these representations, we're getting a particular
persona.
And that in some ways is kind of the thug persona mm-hmm. or the dangerous persona or public threat or public enemy persona. And that the reason that is so harmful is that it becomes the primary one. So that's not the only persona that shows up in rap music. And there's actually some space to understand it as a valid way of expressing a particular emotion among these men.
Mm-hmm.
But it's dominant. And so because it's dominant, even when the other representations show up, they can't compete against that mm-hmm. one.
Now, do you think that's because companies who are producing these records, let's say Capitol Records, let's say Warner Music, they're finding it easier to sell records by appealing to an emotional argument in African-American men versus, let's say, some of the older pioneers of hip-hop, De La Soul, mm-hmm. Jurassic 5, A Tribe Called Quest.
Africana Bambaataa.
Exactly. Where they were using it as a social commentary.
Right. So you're saying, is it more marketable to do kind of the gangster rap
yes.
persona than it is to do the Black nationalist or kind of political activist?
Yeah, like a Mos Def.
That's also a part of hip hop culture. Well, as you were asking that question, I thought about who rap music is being marketed to,
mm-hmm.
and it's being marketed to, studies show over and over again, it's being marketed to suburban European American suburban youth, right? And so, in other words, suburban white kids, right? And even though it appears that it is something that is speaking to the Black community,
sure.
the primary consumers of mainstream pop rap mm-hmm. are people who are not members of this community. and that this genre, this musical genre, becomes a form of rebellion for those kids who are in, you know, maybe middle class suburban mm-hmm. communities. And you really see this, and I'm going to talk about this in the talk. You really see this in terms of like who attends concerts and who buys albums and all
oh,
that.
Oh, yeah.
Right?
Odd Future concerts.
Right. Right. You see all of that. And so you know, that's why one would make the argument that this isn't really for the people, by the people, if mm-hmm. you will. It's really for a community that is outside of the African-American community. Now, with that said, using music as a form of rebellion during youth isn't that bad. Like, we see rock and roll showing up that mm-hmm. way. We see heavy metal. We see other genres showing up that way. The problem, again, is that it is also at the very same time that it becomes the source for rebellion and then becomes commercialized because those people who have the resources to purchase it are purchasing this genre. It becomes the dominant representation of mm-hmm. black men. And it becomes dangerous to black men when we see over-incarceration, when we see racial profiling, that mm-hmm. this persona is more than just a consumption product. It's something that's impacting the entire kind of public sphere understanding of this group. Mm-hmm. And it's very dangerous.
Now, do you think that that perpetuates stereotypes because it is appealing to European suburban youth, right? So in that sense, that's the image that they're getting of the adult inner city white or black male.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. I think it's dangerous because it's not just appealing to them, but it's appealing to everybody.
Mm-hmm.
You know what I mean? So it shows up all over the place. And so it's you know, even maybe one could make the argument the European American police officer who might watch a music video
sure.
before he, you know, puts on his uniform and goes in for his mm-hmm. his shift, you know? So again, it's the dominant. I would make the argument that even though it gets challenged from time to time, it kind of becomes the dominant mm-hmm. representation.
Sure.
And it shows up in other spaces too, not just in rap music. It might show up in movies, other forms of entertainment. You can see, you know, in some instances, something that's reminiscent of the gangster rapper or the Black Thug.
Mm-hmm.
And The Wire. I know it's older now, but
yeah.
The Wire was a perfect example of that.
So let's take this step back a bit, a little more global. Do you think that the majority of the problems that we have identified are uniquely American problems? And if so, what do you base that purely on the diversity that we have in this country as a whole? Or I don't know if you've studied sort of more international type stuff, but what is similar and different in other countries, say like a Germany or a UK?
Very good question. Okay. So the first part that I'm going to take on is that another thing that I always talk to my students about is the fact that we are still living in post-colonialist
sure.
global society, right? We're mm-hmm. we're still living in a world, I should say, not global society, but in a world that is still having a series of racial, cultural, gender, social class hierarchies that were established during Western expansion,
mm-hmm.
during, European expansion and the colonialization process, right? So we're living in either neo-colonialist states, some would argue, or we're living in spaces that are post-colonial but still have those hierarchies in place. So that's one thing that helps us to know that this is not a uniquely American problem, that rather this is the result of the creation of multicultural societies or multiracial societies mm-hmm. that have resulted from the creation of the third world and the first world, and the relationship or the flow of either resources from the third world to the first world
sure.
or the flow of cultural dynamics from the first to the third. So there's a whole bunch of stuff that's still going on because of that relationship. And then because of that, it is absolutely not uniquely American. It's interesting to me when various public officials or public commentators in European nations criticize us,
mm-hmm.
you know, because one of the things that in my global media and culture class we talked about was the French riots of 2005, or it might have been called the Paris riots, where North African youth, who, by the way, North Africans have it pretty darn rough in French society,
mm-hmm.
Were targeted by the police and one young man was killed, and it resulted in riots, and in much the same way that the riots look like here recently. That's something that we don't really think about. And
we don't hear about.
And we don't
hear about. That this is literally the first time I've heard about it. And I like to think that I'm a decently well-read person.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. 2005 Paris riots or French riots, you should look at it because it's so eerily similar mm-hmm. to the type of relationship that marginalized communities of color have to the state.
Sure.
It's kind of freaky how similar it is. And then you also have with the and I apologize for like pulling together this example out of my memory, but the football teams that call players on their team either monkeys or throw mm-hmm. bananas at them, or you know, I know recently there was something, one of my students and I talked about it, something that happened, I want to say it was in the UK.
I think I know where you're going with. Yeah. So a player from Barcelona was taking a corner kick mm-hmm. and somebody threw a banana at him. And instead of reacting, he just kind of picked up the banana and ate it.
Oh, wow.
And then tossed it back, thanked the guy, and then took his corner kick.
Wow. Well,
which
interesting
was
response.
Actually kind of a sweet response, but
it took a lot of self-control to respond that way.
Yeah. But that's actually, I mean, I follow soccer mm-hmm. pretty regularly, and that's definitely one of the biggest things that FIFA has put their money behind mm-hmm, mm-hmm. in that it seems very systemic. I mean, mm-hmm. the Queen's mm-hmm. Park Rangers in England had riots. They had their team attacked on their bus.
That was the one I was thinking okay. of too. Yeah, and then they had their team attacked on the bus mm-hmm. when they were trying to board or something, like the African descent players or the players of color
yep.
couldn't board, was it? That the
I don't know.
Members
I just
of
remember
the,
that.
Like people who were fans were like doing something to them. But mm-hmm. again, that's another example of that. But then it doesn't just show up just even in sports, because I could hear someone from some part of Europe saying, you know, the police versus sports
sure.
fans, and that's different. But police brutality is all across Europe with communities of color. Communities of color are in poor, marginalized neighborhoods in much the same way. Mm-hmm. I mean, the dynamics are very, 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 very similar. The relationship to North Africa and even some parts of some other parts of Africa to Europe in terms of those people migrating into Europe, you know, all of that type of stuff is very similar to the racial dynamics that mm-hmm. show up here. Yeah. And then in other nations that are non-industrialized, I'm sorry, as I was saying that, Australia has a serious race problem. A serious race problem.
Really?
Yes, in not just the indigenous communities, mm-hmm. but also people who are Southeast Asian. Who
really?
Live. Yes, it's a very, very serious problem. And there's actually a gentleman who is a comedian, and I know his last name is Ahmed, and he does this thing on reverse racism. It's mm-hmm. a very funny. He's Australian. He's Bangladeshi, but Australian.
Okay.
I think he lives in Australia, and he talks about it. But he and one of his South Asian, a friend of his that's South Asian, they have something called the Brown Planet or Fear of a Brown Planet, and literally they sound like two African American men. Like they sound like a Chris Rock or even a Dave Chappelle.
Mm-hmm.
And so, so when it comes to the industrialized world, you know, this kind of issue, it's the United States is showing up in Western Europe. It's showing up in Southern and Eastern Europe in some instances. It's definitely very serious in Australia. Then we have the dynamics of kind of quote unquote corruption in developing nations that in my class, at least, we talk about maintaining the status quo relationship between first world nations
and third world nations
and third world, that chaos that's created. So to answer your question, it's not an American problem.
Mm-hmm. Switching gears a bit, I'd like to get into sort of how social media has affected gender roles. And especially one of the things that has really interested me is how social media has played a role in sort of this new feminist movement mm-hmm. that you see. I don't know if you've looked into Tumblr as a medium, but it seems as if this is sort of becoming a platform for a lot of messages that women who would identify as feminists are trying to get across.
Mm, okay. Well, the little bit of research I started to do on it looks at the way that we conflate, use online spaces to conflate feminism with consumption. So mm-hmm. women will engage in the process of boycotting, or men who are feminists, who identify mm-hmm. as feminists, will engage in the process of boycotting products that don't seem to be showing women in a very equitable way or something of that nature. Or I also have seen instances of feminism showing up online where you have different corporations appropriating the messages of feminism for monetary gains. So, you know, so that's what I know about the use of social media as a platform for feminism. In terms of how it shows up in my discussions in class, we look at the ways that it has been appropriated in a post-feminist society to facilitate the process of consumption, and that femininity or being a feminist in both instances show up as connected to your consumption habits. Now, with that said, in terms
is there a heavy correlation between the two?
Between consumption and
identifying as a feminist?
I would say, and this is, again, just from my, you know, reading stuff here and there, I would say there is a more controlled decision-making process for women who see themselves as feminists. Is it Miss Magazine, I want to say? I remember this past semester, we read, in my new media, race and gender class, we read an article that talked about how the editor-in-chief of that magazine selected different corporations to include in that magazine that thought of itself as feminist, and the process of trying to get not just, for instance, car companies to put their ads in the magazine, but to also not focus on the appearance of the car, but rather how the car worked. So that would be considered very feminist to call on advertisers to focus on certain aspects of the car buying process that are usually associated with masculinity. That's kind of like where I'm developing my understanding of that. But then to answer your question about Tumblr and feminism showing up online in the space. Now, is Tumblr used, like, give me a little bit more about the
So basically, it's a blog. You have your page and you reblog other stuff that people do. So at least what I've been seeing and what I kind of researched a little bit before coming in is that, you know, you will have somebody who identifies themselves as a social activist, a feminist social activist, who will gain a lot of followers because there seems to be disproportionate amount of young women who share that viewpoint who are on this website.
Okay.
Who will get a lot of followers and who will post something that will then get thrown around, you know, this entire website and on everybody else's page. And so it's sort of aggregating the ideas that they're trying to push across.
Right. So, okay, to answer that question, and now I am remembering like couple of times I've seen some Tumblr stuff, and it's really reminiscent of the early Google Usenet groups and kind of the beginnings of like kind of posting information that came from another source and reframing that information to coincide with your idea. So this is, there are a couple of different theories to support this, and then I'll come back to your question about feminism. But the first has to do with this idea of the uses and gratifications approach to media consumption that's resulted from media technology, which means that you can take up, first you can only select certain messages that coincide with your pre-existing beliefs. And that's many ways how blogs work. And my dissertation research actually looked at political blogs that are used in this way, that people access these blogs because they have a pre-existing belief, and then it kind of perpetuates the notion. It gets solidified for them. And so that's one thing that we might be seeing showing up in kind of who's accessing this. And so it might not be necessarily that there's a developing feminist movement online, but rather these feminists are finding
more attracted
each other.
To it.
Yeah, and then they're able to have more of an impact because of that uses and gratifications approach. And then also in addition to that, with kind of sharing information in the secondary process, there are two theories that go with that. The first has to do with the creation of a convergence culture, which means we use old media platforms or new media platforms or mixed media platforms to share information. But then in that process, we get to reframe it to sound how we want it to sound. So it's kind of like, so I'm thinking that maybe the stuff that you're talking about with Tumblr is maybe more of that instance. With that said, I would say that that's one of the really cool things about new media spaces is that they allow for connection. They conflate space and time. They allow people who have a specific interest to connect with other people and align those interests. So there's definitely a way in which that can result in something really great in terms of social activism. You know, as a scholar, you have so many theories floating around, but there's also a theory that has to do with kind of how social activism shows up online. And I actually wrote an article in The Conversation that in response to the hashtag Black Lives Matter movement, about kind of translating that phenomenon of that connection into something real on offline in the quote unquote face-to-face world. So we'll see if that if that's what the next step is, then that would be really cool.
Now, has there been precedent for that before? Have they taken an online movement and sort of turned it into a physical real movement? And if so, when and what was it?
So there's research coming out about whether or not Occupy functioned in that way.
Okay.
Like kind of that would be kind of probably the biggest example that scholars are looking at, whether or not Occupy translated into some, which, I mean, on the surface, it at least appeared to translate into a connection in the social, you know, kind of mobilization as a result of people gaining access to each other online, potentially the net neutrality movements. And so there's a way in which it could be. It could be showing up. It's still pretty new and people are trying to figure that out.
Well, thank you so much for taking the time to come over here and do an interview. This is Professor Alberki here on WLVR 91.3.
And thank you so much for having me.
No problem. Tune in next week, guys. Thanks.
You've been listening to Prof Talk. To hear all the interviews and check out extended material, log on to our archives at WLVR.org.